I was gonna say your miscellaneous topic is your birthday.
I could have copped out and done that. I didn't.
No.
God. No, you couldn't have copped out and done that. That was an unacceptable topic.
Especially because it's my main topic. Yeah.
And it's also the question. It's also the question.
Yeah. How old is Carolyn turning? Oh, so awkward. That's when this happens. Oh, guys. Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today we'll be covering a science topic, answering a question, and then hopping into a little miscellaneous topic. My name is Tom, and today's topic is heat and thermal biology. And it is maybe the most unexpectedly endless can of worms I've opened for a topic. It is wild. I'm very excited for it.
Don't know what it means, so I'm excited to learn. I'm Ella, and today's question is, why do humans have periods?
I was, like, gearing up to do a period-based topic, like, soon, so I'm glad you did that. I'm so excited. My name's Caroline, and this episode's miscellaneous topic is going to be the history of stickers.
That's very fun.
I'm excited for that.
It's not too convoluted, but it's a fun little story. So, yeah.
Are you going to talk to us about the science of adhesive?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No.
No science in the miscellaneous topic.
No science in the miscellaneous topic. I refuse.
I'm so curious. And as always, y'all can also support us on Patreon, where we are. We just released our first bonus episode of our bonus show, ETC. And it was delightful to do. So,
if you listened to it and are already on the Patreon with us, then let us know what you thought on the Discord, where you could also join us and talk about the podcast and other science and miscellaneous things.
And if you like the Discord, you should listen to our podcast, Let's Learn Everything.
And if you listen to our podcast, you should think about supporting us on Patreon.
Links for everything are at letslearneverythingpod.com.
There we go.
Thanks
there
for being actually useful.
Nailed it.
Today's topic is going to be heat and thermal biology. And before we get to some of the rowdy animal facts, because there are some, I want to start with what seems like a really basic question, but something that when I finally internalized it really changed how I think about a lot of things. And the question is, what is heat?
Particles moving faster. More energy. Those things.
Energy.
Yeah.
I just know it's one way that we lose energy.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I'm being completely honest, I never really learned this, like really intuited it in my bones, what heat was, until I read Feynman's Six Easy Pieces, like a year out of college. It's a wonderful book. It's like the first time I felt like I was actually learning physics in my life, like really learning it. So I'm just going to read from that book for like a half hour real quick.
Perfect.
Just you can read?
Whoa! How do you come back from that, Tom?
We got to restart. I can't recover from that one. So everything in the world is made of particles. We know this. If you imagine like an ice cube made up of a bunch of rigid water molecules so that it stays solid. But the thing is, like, as solid as it is, the molecules are all actually jiggling a tiny bit, a microscopic amount. And I swear that is the exact word that Feynman uses, is jiggling. That's not just me being silly.
Perfect.
And that microscopic shimmying, the energy from those molecules, is what heat is. Listeners who study physics, I know there's like a million caveats, please forgive me. But if you think about taking that ice and putting it in warm air, which is wiggling a lot more, what will happen is that the warm air molecules will start shimmying against the ice molecules and transfer that wiggliness until the ice starts to wiggle more and eventually melt. It's just like, I think Carolyn put it pretty best. It's just little wiggling of molecules. And it's really interesting because thinking of heat in that way as like a physical phenomena instead of like a weather thing or like a psychological thing makes a lot of things make sense to me. Like, that's why heat spreads and dissipates. That's why blowing on food works, because you're moving the hot air away. It's also why space is cold, because even though the sun is blasting photons and radiation, there's no air to jiggle. There's no molecules to wiggle, right? So that's why space is cold.
I just want to rest with that one for a second.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to go with that, but like thinking of heat as this tiny wiggling of molecules really changed the way I think a lot about things. But another really interesting way to think about heat and temperature isn't just how it works in physics, but how it works in biology, because heat is essential for life, basically. Temperature is one of the key factors in how life maintains homeostasis, right? That your internal balance. And there's a lot of really interesting quirks to how animals go about thermoregulating, which is how we get into the realm of thermal biology. So at first, the way I've set it up, thermal biology seems like pretty straightforward. Like, heat is really intuitive to us. It's like, stay warm. Warm is good. Pretty straightforward. But boy howdy, maybe this is just like extremely up my alley, but looking at biology through the lens of heat has just been so fascinating. And I had no idea until I started researching this. Therm is now my new favorite prefix and suffix. There's going to be a lot of therm words, and I'm going to try and show y'all why I find this so exciting. So,
yep, Tom's rubbing his little hands.
Mischievously. So I feel like most of us have heard the term warm-blooded and cold-blooded when it comes to animals, right?
Yeah.
Ellen, Carolyn, I don't know if you can give a brief explanation of what those mean.
I actually can't. It's one of those things that I just like never, ever decided to learn.
We're gonna learn a lot then. Carolyn, do you?
I mean, I really should know a proper definition for it. But in my head, warm-blooded is like they can regulate their own body temperature.
Yes.
Whereas animals that are cold-blooded, need external help to regulate their body temperature, which is why, like, lizards will bask in the sun. It's to heat them up and to be able to move.
Exactly.
I should have been able to guess that.
Nailed it.
So it's not necessarily that cold-blooded animals are always cold. They just can't make their own heat, or the amount that they make is negligible, and they need external things to help them regulate their heat. Some of y'all, maybe taking AP biology, may have heard better terms for this. Endotherms and ectotherms are another way you can say this. Endotherms being sort of warm-blooded animals that can generate their own internal heat through metabolic systems, through all kinds of internal physiological systems. And then ectotherms are animals that get their heat from the environment. So now that we know the basics, I'm going to stop throwing textbook definitions at y'all, because I think that the best way to learn this is actually with the absolutely wild edge cases that sort of break this paradigm a bit. In 2020, only 2 years ago, or what feels like 4 months, depending on who you ask, in 2020, scientists accidentally measured one of the highest functioning body temperatures in an animal so far.
Oh, wow.
Can you guess what that animal was? And also, listen, all you nerds out there, I know you're jumping to say tardigrades. You all want to say tardigrades. Listen, gold star, but tardigrades are off the table here. We won't be talking about microscopic animals. That's a whole other topic for another day. I'm sorry. But so, those aside.
Maybe something like a crab.
Can I have a clue?
Yeah, I have a few clues. So, I mean, for reference, the human body temperature is around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees Celsius.
Ella is shaking her head.
Yeah, so don't even put the Fahrenheit in there. Everyone who's listening to this, learn fucking metric, okay?
No, absolutely not.
Jesus.
I have this written in both. Listen, I need it. I need it for my baby American brain.
So, and how high was the temperature?
Oh, we'll get to it.
It can't be higher than, like, the, you know, the boiling point of water.
Of course, really. of course. But, I mean, that's an interesting limit to sort of think about, because that does affect it. And we'll get into that, but yeah.
Is it something that lives in an extremely hot environment?
So, my first thought was to jump to animals like camels that live in hot environments like deserts. But the temperature of the environment is only part of the equation. It is part of it. But
okay.
What's just as important is how the animal is handling it in its body, because it's body temperature, not ambient temperature. So I learned this. Even though they live in opposite climates, polar bears and camels are both really close to 98 Fahrenheit or 36.6 degrees Celsius in body temperature.
Uh-huh, that makes sense,
and
I guess.
This is where some scientists think that the dichotomy of warm-blooded, cold-blooded, endothermic, ectothermic isn't actually enough. Because humans aren't just warm, they're consistently warm, right? Our thermoregulatory system isn't just like a fire that we stoke, it's like a thermostat, right, that can keep us at the right temperature. So
yeah.
This is a great quote from a paper by Ostrovsky, Williams, and Ismail. They go, "Many species of endotherms, so warm-blooded animals, control their core body temperature within narrow limits, plus or minus 3.5 Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius, even when subjected to a wide range of environmental temperatures, a process called homeothermy." So humans, birds, most mammals are what's known as homeotherms. They maintain a consistent heat, but you also have examples of animals that could be called heterotherms. And these are animals that alternate between different temperature ranges. So an example of this are animals that hibernate, like bears, where they will dip into much lower temperatures and then cycle back to match sort of the fluctuating seasons. Desert camels and oryx will also often cycle both between day and night, as well as seasonal changes in both their water storage and their rest behavior, and their temperature can change as much as 7.2 Fahrenheit or 4 degrees Celsius in a single day, which is a lot more than ours would. And then, of course, you have what I think is a delightful word. This was one of my favorite words I learned coming across this is poikilotherms. Poikilo meaning varied. So those are animals that can live and function in a wide range of temperatures. So these are your reptiles, your arthropods, and most other animals, actually. And they can, function over a wide range of body temperatures on the span of like 10 to 30 degrees Celsius change, which is wild.
That's insane.
And it's an interesting way to rethink about it, because it's not just like hot blood, cold blood, it's like consistent and varied. So I just think that's a really fascinating way to think about this. I will say these definitions aren't like solid rules in biology, right? Like it's some folks use endotherm and homeotherm interchangeably, some use slightly different words with like different Greek and Latin prefixes, and of course there's a lot of exceptions. We're going to get to them because they're exciting, but these terms serve to sort of remind us that it's not as simple as just like cold and warm blood. There's lots of interesting things that animals do to regulate temperature inside, outside their body. And so we'll finally get to the answer. Do we have, and has that changed any of your guesses at all?
I want to know which of those categories it falls into. Is that too much of a hint to give?
No advantageous reason I could think that you would have a resting really high temperature, because it's very energy inefficient to keep it that way, I would assume.
That's a really interesting way to think about it. Yeah, Ella, as a sort of, what behaviors does this animal do that would make it keep this high temperature?
So wait. Okay, so wait. I know this is not the question section, but I'm
no,
treating
yeah,
it
of
like
course. I know. I'm so no. This is great.
Animals that have like the lower their body temperature, like bears, they do it when they're like sedentary. It's like an energy preservation method, partly, and I'm sure there are other reasons. So if it must be the opposite way around, right? So whatever the animal's doing, it must be doing like a lot of it. It's like it's really highly energetic, like moving or digesting. I don't know, something.
Ooh.
You know,
Ella, you are exactly right.
Is it something like a desert mouse or something crazy like that?
So I think Ella's closest to the money on this. So there's kind of two answers. One is by a poikilotherm. And it's basically a desert lizard that just gets to an amazing temperature by just like baking in the sun, basically.
Okay.
But there is actually like Ella said, there's a homeotherm, that was able to get to as high, if not higher, of a temperature and still be completely fine. And that is the story from the 2020 paper. So the article was published in Nature by Freeman, Chenzi, Schumann, and McKechnie, and it's titled Extreme Hyperthermia Tolerance in the World's Most Abundant Wild Bird.
Oh!
Pigeon!
So, I don't...
Chicken! No, it's... Oh, no, it's wild. Wild bird. Wait, sparrow.
we will get into it. So
I want to know.
What's amazing about this article is that because it was published in 2020, it doesn't just have a paper. It has a delightful human-readable blog post that McKechnie wrote that's also on Nature's website. And here's a quote from it. Over the last decade, my collaborators, students, and I have investigated the thermal physiology and heat tolerance of around 60 desert bird species. One species not on our target list was the red-billed Quelea. One quiet day, when our target species were proving elusive, Mark and Zen happened to catch a couple of Quelias in their mist nets and decided to take a closer look at the species' thermal physiology. What began as a routine respirometry run turned into a jaw-dropping afternoon as the body temperature of the Quelias passed... And then this is the temperature, so for reference... Human, again, body temperature, 98.6 Fahrenheit, 37 Celsius. The desert oryx, which we mentioned earlier, it peaks at around 105 Fahrenheit, 40.5 Celsius in like the high desert heat. And for the Quelias, they were able to measure highs over 118 Fahrenheit or 48 Celsius.
Whoa!
Wow.
Quote, without any ill effects. To put that in perspective... That is 7 degrees Fahrenheit from a rare steak. Like that, you are 7 degrees away from turning into my Applebee's order. That is truly scary almost. So to quote the study, these values exceed known avian lethal limits with tolerance of body temperature greater than 48 degrees Celsius, unprecedented among birds and mammals.
Wow.
The blog continues, after a phone call to the initially incredulous PI in Pretoria, quote, me, red-billed Quelias were rapidly elevated to the top of our priority list. I just want to say, as a side note, we need so much more of these stories in science. Like, I think, you know, academic language is important, but this human writing is just as important, and I love it for that. So. I love this, you know, not just because this bird is like a few degrees away from becoming my next meal, but actually exactly for that reason, because this is a quote from the paper on Quelias. They go, body temperature of vertebrates are thought to be limited below 45 to 47 Celsius by the thermal sensitivity of cellular macromolecules and oxygen supply limitation. Among terrestrial vertebrates, critical thermal maxima for squamate reptiles, rodents, and birds are usually below 46 degrees Celsius. So there are, kind of like what Ella said about how, obviously, you know, they can't be above boiling, like, there are chemical reasons why it's dangerous to get any hotter, which is so fascinating to me because you have this physics property, heat, that dictates a chemical limit of a biological organism, right? I love these interdisciplinary topics like this.
There are like certain just proteins, which I assume that birds and humans share, that we know in humans only operate at like certain temperatures.
Yeah.
Well, body temperature, which is around 37 degrees. And I'm sure that like some proteins start to like denature.
Yeah, exactly.
Above a certain temperature. So that how do they know anything about why this bird is like how it accommodates, you know, for the changes? Or is it too new for that?
It's just a little too new for that, I believe. Also, you know, these systems are very complex, but, you know, we do have theories about how they get to this high of a temperature in the first place, which is a combination of the high desert heat. And also the fact that, like you sort of said, Ella, like, flying is a lot of work. And so, you know, they definitely reach these heats. As to how their bodies can tolerate this, I'm not 100% sure. I don't know if we even know yet. But there is one other really interesting thing that this sort of also brings up. And there's a slight chance you may have noticed why this is a little curious. I've mentioned it in the quote briefly, but like the two main groups of endothermic, like homeotherms, are mammals and birds. You know, they make their own body heat and they maintain it. Do you know why that fact alone is kind of interesting?
No.
The last common ancestor between birds and mammals was likely not endothermic or homeothermic.
Okay.
Because, right, like, as much as we take it for granted, like, making your own heat, being warm-blooded, is an adaptation.
Yeah.
And it seems to have happened...
twice. Separately, yeah.
Yes. This is a quote from a paper by Clark and Portner titled Temperature, Metabolic Power, and the Evolution of Endothermy. Endothermy has evolved at least twice in the precursors to modern mammals and birds. The most widely accepted explanation for the evolution of endothermy has been selection of enhanced aerobic capacity. Wild to think about, and something we just take for granted. It's like, you know, some animals are warm, some are cold. But like, there could be evolutionary theories why. And just to show you how wild this field is of like evolutionary thermal biology, what I just read was the first line of the abstract of the paper. This is the last line of the abstract. I'm not kidding. Large dinosaurs were warm, but were not endotherms, and the metabolic status of pterosaurs remains unresolved.
What's a pterosaur?
Those are like pterodactyls, I believe. So this is, I hope y'all are seeing like how thermal biology has like quickly become this loose thread I have not been able to stop pulling. This episode could go on forever, because everything deals with heat, because everything is in the physical world. I'm going to mention a few rapid facts. Any curious minds out there, I highly recommend looking these up. Maybe share what you find in the Discord. So it wouldn't be this podcast if I didn't mention bees, who are ectothermic. You know, they're insects. They can't maintain their own body heat through metabolic processes, but their hives are around 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 Celsius. And they're able to relatively maintain that. Where does that place them? I don't know.
It's so cool that their hives are that, because they generate that heat through.
Yeah, through like shimmying.
And I imagine that they generate to an extent that like, if it is too hot in the day, that they
yes.
do less shimmying.
They regulate it.
When
yes.
it's cold, they do it. Which
so
means
cool.
they have like their own sense. They have their own thermometer.
Yeah.
And it's a group thermometer.
That's exactly. Fascinating. I wish I had another hour for all
bees.
Of this. I swear to God, I have so many articles. I was like, I can't go down another rabbit hole. Hey all, quick editor's note that I came across some research that there is actually an animal that gets even hotter than the desert quelea and the desert lizard, and that is the desert ant, Cataglyphus, which is found at temperatures of 122 degrees Fahrenheit or 50 degrees Celsius. So I was wrong about that. Never been more delighted to be wrong about something before. And happy to be wrong again. Let me know if you find any animal that gets to an even higher temperature. Some animals change their color to regulate heat, because obviously some colors absorb more heat from light than others. Wild. On to the next fact. There is evidence of heat generation or thermogenesis in some plants.
Oh!
Hmm.
Do you guys know why that might be? Why they might do this?
Because it's cold.
That could be a reason. One of the theories is that it's to spread the odor of their pollen, especially in Helicodiceros, also known as the dead horse arum, which smells like death, to attract flies, who then act as pollinators.
Nice, makes sense.
Lovely.
So the theory is that they heat up to spread the putrid smell to attract flies. Fascinating. Next fact. There are some theories that maybe endothermic and ectothermic is like a false binary. Like, this is a quote from an article. Many elements of mammalian and avian thermoregulatory mechanisms are present in reptiles, and the changes involved in the transition to endothermy are more quantitative than qualitative. wild. Maybe this is all not even a thing.
All absolute nonsense.
There's also obviously a huge area of study into how global warming will affect thermoregulation in ecosystems, you know, not just internal processes, but like bodies of water, which some animals use critically to like maintain their internal temperature.
If your, you know, range of temperature is can only go 2 degrees either way, like the 1 degree increase in in ocean temperature is like huge. It's like a huge deal, right? So
totally especially for those animals that can't regulate their own body temperature and depend on the environment. And of course there are astrophysics theories about what is the range of temperatures of planets that are conducive to life at all. There is so much. I had to pull my head out of so many rabbit holes researching this, but to end the topic, to get our heads back down on Earth, I just want to zoom in back on two animals that were my favorite to learn about. So one of the wildest facts I found in researching is that we know of at least two mammals who are generally endothermic homeotherms. They maintain their own consistent body heat. There are two examples of mammals that seem to be poikilothermic, meaning they can exist across a wide range of internal body temperatures like a reptile would be able to.
Ooh.
Do you know what those two animals are?
Do you say they're mammals?
Yeah.
Bats?
I will say bats are also very interesting because, you know, being one of the only flying mammals, they also have like a really high temperature. But that's not it. It's...
Wait, no!
I just want to help you out. It's wild. Like, it's not like, oh, that makes sense. It's kind of like...
Naked mole rats.
Yeah. Yes, that is one of them.
Oh my god.
How did you...
Naked mole rats are really weird animals.
Correct. Yeah.
Like, that's not the only weird thing about them.
Oh no, they're fascinating. But that is one of the very weird things about them. Yeah, they're...
Well done.
Oh my god, yeah. I will say the other one is like another classic outlier strange mammal.
Platypus.
Is it a platypus?
No, it is not a platypus, but it is it's a similar vein of like these fuckers always show up on the top 10 lists of weird animals.
Oh, go on.
So we'll talk about naked mole rats in a second, but for the first animal, I'm going to be reading excerpts from two studies, one by Cliff et al. And one by Britton and Atkinson. Just going to be interspersing the quotes just because they're so delightful on their own. So this is the first quote. Three-fingered sloths are an enigma within the classic poikilotherm homeotherm groupings. This is another quote. It was found that occasionally the temperature of the sloths vary rather rapidly and wildly for no apparent reason. The experimental condition were not responsible, and the activity of the animals did not appear to be involved. A few other species of tropical animals that were tested, ocelots, marmosets, white-faced monkeys, showed practically no reduction in body temperature. Most peculiarly, their body temperature may fluctuate up to 18 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius over a 24-hour period.
That's so bizarre.
So, this is another quote, they go, anecdotally, they are suggested to behave like reptiles by making behavioral and postural adjustments which are used to control the rates of heat gain and loss. One last quote, instead, there is speculation that this poikilothermic strategy might enable sloths to have the lowest metabolic rates of non-hibernating animals, some 40 to 74% of the predicted value relative to the body mass. You know, as much as I love the phrases like homeotherm and poikilotherm to think about this, I also equally love the weird exceptions or things that sort of make us rethink how we think about this.
Like, I remembered why I thought it was the naked mole rat.
Yeah.
And why my other guess would have been an opossum.
Ooh.
Because opossums, you know, they don't carry rabies because their body temperature is so low, so it can't survive.
Oh.
Which is another interesting thermal thing for you, Tom.
Yeah.
And naked mole rats are like crazy disease resistant.
Wow.
Cancer has never been seen in a naked mole rat.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that's like unheard of in a mammal. So I think that's why I thought that maybe I was thinking about the rabies thing and getting confused, but it ended up being true anyway, because naked mole rats are really weird.
They're so strange. I love As much as I love bees as being the animals of this podcast, I love this stable of strange animals that I hope we get to see across multiple episodes. Because it clearly intersects with like so many other things. Wild. On to the naked mole rat. Their internal temperatures will often stay just 1 degree Celsius above the temperature of the air, which is fascinating for a mammal. They can survive internal, like, body temperature. Their body temperature can change from 50 Fahrenheit to 99 Fahrenheit, or 10 Celsius to 37 Celsius, which is wild.
Wow.
But the thing is, that makes this very interesting, is that in the wild, naked mole rats don't often get to such a low temperature for very long, even though they can survive it. And do you know why they don't?
No idea.
Because they're underground.
So the answer is maybe my favorite word of this whole topic, and it is kleptothermy.
Fun.
Stealing heat.
Exactly. Which is such a great concept that I'd never even thought about. So this is a paper from Corkery, Bell, and Nelson titled Investigating Kleptothermy, a Reptile Seabird Association with Thermal Benefits, which association with thermal benefits sounds like a great fanfiction category, which I will say. So the paper goes, we provide evidence that a close association between a medium-sized reptile, the tuatara, and a small seabird, the fairy prion, enables the reptile to maintain higher than average body temperatures, which is so fascinating.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
But that's not what the naked mole rats are doing, because the most common form of kleptothermy isn't actually stealing heat, it's sharing heat through huddling.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's so sweet.
There must be other animals that are kleptotherms in sense as well, like penguins or something.
Exactly, yeah. So, a study by Yahav and Buffenstein found that when alone or in pairs, naked mole rats will be poikilothermic. Their body temperature will be like just barely higher than that of the air. But in groups of four or more, they will huddle together and keep their temperature stable within 1 degree Celsius across changing air temperature.
Oh.
Which is so cool, or rather, so warm.
Oh, God.
Hey!
But I almost killed Ella with that joke. What blew me away, and why I mentioned this, and why I saved the naked mole rats for last, is that there was a quote from this paper by Yahav and Buffenstein that said, huddling behavior is known to have important thermoregulatory consequences in most mammals. Indeed, thermoregulatory advantages as a result of huddling have been documented for all terrestrial animal classes. For example, birds, mammals, insects, and reptiles. And then they go on to cite a source for every animal there that they mention. And what for me is so like uncanny, what's so cool about that is that a bunch of animals wiggling up next to each other is what molecules do when they transfer heat. Like, you have this complex social biology analog to a physical phenomena. And that's why thermal biology is so cool to me. I want to be clear. Listen, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that there's some, like, grand unifying theory of heat and life. No, absolutely not. In fact, most of these rules keep getting broken, and there are often more exceptions. But one of my favorite things is a concept that can, like, cut across multiple disciplines and reveal a cross-section that you've never seen before. It's like adding the third dimension of heat to the graph suddenly reveals all these, like, new patterns that you didn't see before. Like, the best thing is a new perspective that, like, opens a lot of doors and raises a lot of questions, and I think heat is one of them. And I just found that so, 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 so interesting to think about that. And that's the topic.
That was great, Tom.
Your
enthusiasm was particularly good.
It's so cool! I don't know why. I can't believe you got naked mole rats. That was a great guess.
I will also say, on your physics and biology unifying thing theory, human shiver to generate heat, right? And that's literally the same thing. And then also, insects vibrate their wings when they're cold together, like to warm them up. So that's another, you know, jiggling around.
There's so much. It's so great. Jiggling.
Jiggling.
That'll be the name of the episode. It'll be episode 11, Jiggling.
It's all just jiggling.
Today's question is, why do humans have periods? Deep breath.
So, I know, like, why we have periods.
Right, like the health class answer.
I'm gonna correct you there. You know what a period is.
I know what a period is.
Ooh!
And there is a distinction.
Actually, yeah, like, what uses are periods, or, like, why we have periods and why some animals don't have periods, and all of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As someone who doesn't have periods, I need you all to hold me to be the person to say my dumb answer first, and I will volunteer that. That is my duty.
I think you'll be okay, but I thought this would be a good place to start is what is a period? What is menstruation?
So let me just really quickly mansplain menstruation to you all. I offer this only because I know
I want to know. It's definitely useful to hear it from the perspective of someone who doesn't.
So I believe menstruation is when it's the uterine lining, right?
Yeah.
It falls apart when an egg is not fertilized, and so it just leaves the body because there was no baby.
No egg implantation.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, that's like very much the true. Do you have any expansion on that, Caroline? Any, like, you know, science words?
Oh, okay. The thing with me and humans is don't like them.
I have also heard this.
I know that it involves some expansion of the cervix and some cramping.
I think that's probably true.
And like some like teeny tiny little contractions to help get rid of that lining, which is why we have cramps.
Oh my god, I actually didn't know that, so that's good to know.
Yeah, but that's about all I can properly. And there's a bunch of hormones involved in the process.
So I will. There are some words we need to know here just to move on with. So I'll basically restate what you already said, Tom, but with science. So it's the shedding of the inner lining of the uterus, like you said, but this is called the endometrium. Or it's the top layer of the endometrium through the vagina, and it's triggered by decreased levels of the hormone progesterone due to the implanting of a fertilized egg not occurring. That's it. But I should say, a disclaimer, that's for the most part, you can still have a period when you're pregnant. I just don't want anyone listening to this podcast and getting pregnant and then not realizing they are because they have a period. It can still happen, especially if it happens, if you get pregnant just before your period, just so you know.
So you should always... You should always pee on wheat and barley.
Yes, exactly.
Listeners, that was a throwback to episode 5? 6?
That was a good episode. You should listen to it if you haven't. My next question is, who menstruates? What animals menstruate?
Oh, of animals. Oh.
Do dogs have something similar? But I don't think it's actually a period. It's something different.
Yeah, I was running this question. Oh, I was running this question by the people I work with today, and they all were like, "Yeah, dogs have periods," and I was like, "Nope, they don't. They definitely don't." And they bleed.
Whoa.
And they go through oestrus, so they have like a cycle where they go through heat, and during heat, there is an increase of blood flow to the uterus, so they'll bleed, and the bleeding is thought to be like a. But it can be like a way to attract mates, basically. But it's not a period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're not menstruating. Okay.
Can I guess?
Yeah, please do.
Do any other, like, apes menstruate?
That was going to be, because yeah. My first guess was all mammals, but if not, then my next guess would then be, yeah, like Carolyn.
It's almost no mammals. It's almost no one.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really, really rare, isn't it?
So apes do. I think all apes do. And something called, old world monkeys, which include, I've got down here howler monkeys and drills. So apes include like gorillas, orangutans, bonobos, humans, and old world monkeys. And then the other two kinds of animals that have periods.
No.
So wild.
No, hold on. Don't. If you say sloths and naked mole rats, I'm going to.
No.
Okay. Bees?
No insects. It's elephant shrews.
Oh. What is an elephant shrew? I was going to say elephant might make. Elephant
tiny little rodent, aren't they?
You should Google an image of them now because they're so fucking cute and they're tiny. They're really, really, really small.
I just want to add that it's so interesting that, like, there are other animals that have periods, but you never really hear about it in, like, any sort of, like, documentaries or anything. Like, it's never something that seems to be talked about when you watch those sorts of things.
Because most animals don't.
But even, gorilla documentaries,
oh, yeah, you don't really hear about it. That's the point. I guess they don't, it probably doesn't affect them in the same way, which is something we'll get into a bit more.
I'm sorry. These things are so cute.
Right?
Lord. And they... Why? Why do they? That's wild.
I actually don't know specifically why those do, but the other kind of animal, it's actually only four species of this animal, is bats.
Wow!
Which is why I guessed bats before and yours. Four species of bats have periods.
Good Lord.
Why?
Who knows? Only four?
To what Tom sort of touched on earlier, does that mean periods have evolved different times?
This is what I was going to tell you. This is what it links back to. So this links back to what Tom was talking about. This is convergent evolution. None of the things we evolved from, we believe, had menstruated. This is something that was developed over time, specifically in these animals.
Absolutely. That's so wild. Cool.
Yeah.
And it's so specifically in some mammals. Like, that's such a... And again, like, these are not, like...
Bats is such a weird one.
Feel like such wild cards.
Yeah.
We've talked about what periods are and who and what animals have them. I'll slowly kind of unravel more information and then I'll ask you. Yes. So is there any further guesses as to why do periods...
Why do periods?
I have a sort of question of, like, are periods the same sort of thing happening in each of those species? Obviously different hormones, but like the same overall process. Okay, yeah.
Does my grand unifying theory of heat hold here? Is there I don't know. Gosh, I really don't know.
Is it a more effective way of getting pregnant? Or something like that.
You know what? That's not a bad idea. And I think actually that you could make an argument for that.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly changes the way pregnancy works.
Yeah. Okay.
I was going to wonder if it had to do with like gestational period, but I think, you know, elephants and whales also have a very long gestational period and it seems like they don't, so maybe it's unrelated to that.
Oh, how about I'll tell you this, that although this is true for some animals that don't menstruate, bats, elephant shrews, apes, they have very few offspring, like very, very few offspring. Bats have I thought the bats have loads, but they just don't. They have elephant shrews will only get pregnant a maximum of three times in their lives.
Wow. That's wild.
And it's not even to do with how long you take care of the offspring, because there are animals that, like humans, that take care of offsprings for a very long time too. Yeah. And elephant shrews don't, so...
Does it have anything to do with, like, the energy that goes into producing, like, an egg or something?
You know what? And the energy thing is such a good question. It's such an interesting thought, and I think we will come back round to that.
Okay.
So... to understand why we have periods, what we need to understand is something called decidualization.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, another great word today!
It basically just means changes in the endometrium in preparation for pregnancy.
Got it.
So it includes like the recruitment of white blood cells to the area, and blood vessels really increase. It's called angiogenesis, like a huge increase in blood supply to the area. And then differentiation of a cell type called endometrial stromal fibroblast cells to a different type of cell called decidual stromal fibroblast cells. All of these things have like reasons, and we will.
It's like prepping the space.
Yeah, and we will. Some of these we'll come back to think about a bit more. So, in many uterine animals with uteruses, decidualization is a completely necessary. It's kind of like a maternal solution to accommodating the embryo, basically. But it happens differently in animals that menstruate and those that don't. So, in humans and other menstruating animals, decidualization is spontaneous, which means it's controlled by the hormones in the body, regardless of whether or not there is a pregnancy. It will always happen.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
In non-menstruating animals, decidualization is triggered by the embryo. Basically, the fertilized egg triggers the same thing happens. The endometrium will grow to accommodate the embryo, but it'll be delayed in implanting until it's ready.
Mm, okay.
Honestly, engineering-wise, that makes sense to me, you know, to have it triggered by that.
So does the same. So then why do humans and bats and elephant shrews have spontaneous decidualization?
Spontaneous decidualization. That's so great.
It does having more time to develop that lining benefit the pregnancy in some way?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, for sure. Having the lining already there is beneficial.
Great point. That's a great point.
To both the fetus and the mother.
And then I guess having a fresh lining is also...
Well, the lining is always fresh, regardless of whether or not... Oh, I guess
if it's always inside, yeah.
So, and there's... I'm going to give you the name of the hypothesis.
Ooh, love a good hypothesis.
I would say is like the leading hypothesis right now as to why we have spontaneous decidualization and therefore periods. And it's called the maternal-fetal conflict hypothesis.
Was not expecting that word.
Yeah.
Conflict
would not be in my top 100 words for this hypothesis.
Is conflict in terms of like, in the same way that we reject organs that come from somebody else, we reject the fetus?
You're not completely off base there.
Okay. I'm trying to think now. Nope.
They have different genetics. That is part of it. Does that give you anything?
Is it like conflict of competing for resources, maybe?
Exactly.
Oh, is it? Okay. That's
exactly what it is. They have different evolutionary interests. Okay? So the fetus...
Oh boy.
Or the genes of the fetus have evolved to get as much as possible from the mother to ensure survival and ultimately propagation of genes. But the maternal genes have evolved to promote success, not just of the current offspring, but also future offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it has to protect the mother to some extent.
Yeah.
So the fetus, or rather the placenta, which supports it, is incredibly invasive to get the resources it needs.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
It moves into like the mother's bloodstream, into different organs. Like, it's been very, very invasive. And out of all species, it's probably the most invasive placenta, including the other animals that have periods.
Periods. Wild.
So decidualization is thought to have evolved both to benefit the fetus and the mother as a protective mechanism.
Okay.
I said there were immune cells that were brought to the area. Well, this prevents infection because you've got like a foreign body living in you, basically. Uh-huh. The structure of the endometrium itself is like a wall, like a protective wall. It's like these really large, very tightly bound cells together, and that's stopping too much invasion. But those cells I told you about, the decidual stromal fibroblast cells, One of the things they do is they lose expression of genes which prevent tissue invasion so that the embryo is allowed to be more invasive. And is not seen as like that foreign thing, right? Which I thought was really interesting. So I actually made a TikTok about this. And in my TikTok, I said on the subject, I said, pregnancy is a parasitic relationship.
Yeah, I do remember this.
And oh boy, did I get some backlash from that.
I'm not surprised by that one. I was thinking it whilst you were saying all of this and was like, I should not say that out loud. I should keep that in my head.
Yeah, we all had the thought. We all were like...
You know, at the time I was going off of kind of like just vague reading, but doing a lot more like deep research into this, there I found a quote from a paper called The Evolution of Menstruation. And this quote is... The conflict hypothesis predicts an evolutionary tug of war between maternal and fetal genomes, similar to virus host interactions in which moves by one party are matched by counter moves of the other. This is an actual, very good, actually, academic paper saying that the mother-fetus relationship is like a virus and a host.
Wow.
Wow.
I love academics. They can say whatever.
And we should say, like, these are... hypotheses and frameworks of thinking about this isn't some
it's not also it's non-emotional, it's like resources.
That's a great point mm-hmm.
They're not like attributing this to the way you should view like a baby.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is one other aspect to the paternal fetal conflict hypothesis that I find really interesting. It's called a genomic imprinting. So obviously I've talked about the mother's interest and I've talked about the fetus's interest. But we have a third party involved, don't we?
What, the placenta?
The sperm giver.
The sperm giver, the father.
Yeah.
The fetus inherits genes from the father, and some are activated in the placenta, and these genes promote, like, the welfare of the offspring at the mother's expense.
Nice. Yay. Love that.
Which I thought was, like, that's just... crazy to me. So the second hypothesis, which ties into this first one, I'll tell you what it's called, and you can, I think you'll probably be able to guess what it is from that. It's called embryo selection. Any thoughts?
Is this tied into like the male wanting?
No, it is kind of tied into the maternal fetal conflict hypothesis.
Does the spontaneous deciduization allow the, you know, like an egg that isn't particularly good to be, or to like check on the egg before it even gets inseminated?
Exactly.
Oh.
Wow.
That is exactly it. So it's basically the endometrium is like a testing ground. So
wow.
Like we said, pregnancy is like incredibly energetically expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And also invasive to the level of dangerous. So if the mother does not want to go through it unnecessarily, if the offspring isn't going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
All of these facts and stuff will be in the show notes in the papers. But so genetic analysis of morphologically normal, high quality embryos during IVF showed that around 70% of embryos have complex chromosomal abnormalities, which means they won't be viable. And that's 10 times higher than any other mammalian species.
Wow.
Humans have incredibly inefficient pregnancies. It's crazy. So basically, if the uterine lining is ready for implantation, the embryo can be tested for viability, like you said, Tom.
Wow.
If it's defective, it can be expelled. And how is it expelled?
Through the period.
Wow.
Yeah, so after every ovulation that didn't end in a healthy pregnancy, the entire top layer of the endometrium is shed.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, though, you don't get pregnant every single period. So it's kind of like a huge hack job of evolution.
Yeah. Just every month. Yeah. Right? That sounds right.
It kind of solved the problem, but it did it in such like a very brutal way.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And it's also like, that's incredibly energetically expensive.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, we are using so many resources to produce this lining every month just to get rid of it, which other animals don't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to protect itself. But I did find out apparently when we were hunter-gatherers, this made a lot more sense because women would be pregnant more frequently, so in which case you wouldn't have a period.
Yeah.
And then there's a long period after pregnancy called lactational amenorrhea, where you're breastfeeding, so you don't have periods. And that would be much, much longer than it is in modern day years. So then you die a lot younger as well. So there was an estimate of how many periods women would have around this time, and it was like something like 50. It was like really low.
Rude.
Wow.
Some bullshit.
At the end of all that, can one of you tell me why we have periods?
Okay. So first thing is to double check them eggs. Make sure they are egg okay. And then I'm trying to think of like a good way of summarizing everything from the first half.
From my perspective, right, I went into this, and when you first explained, like, why not do the situation with prepping it? Why not do it after you've checked the pregnancy first? I was like, that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there are, like you said, valid reasons like offering a buffer of protection.
Yeah.
Beforehand, right, in preparation, and also, like you said, like Carolyn mentioned, as a way to
almost like screening, isn't it?
It's all preparatory mechanisms, mm-hmm. which when you think about it that way, make a lot more sense. And I hadn't thought about that.
You couldn't do it after in a human or something within something with such an invasive placenta because if it wasn't there, it would implant anyway, basically. Yeah.
And then there just wouldn't be any of those buffers in place.
Yeah, in non-spontaneous decidualizing animals, the embryo doesn't implant immediately, but in humans, it does.
Ah.
Interesting. And I'm sure that's a whole other... This gets into, you know, why does this happen? And then why does that happen? And I'm sure there's tons of reasons. Because,
is like a huge, it's a big evolutionary kind of question.
Right.
This is only in the last 10 years, 10, 15 years that this theory has become more like leading. One of the big ones before that, which I'm not going to talk about in any detail, but it was sperm-borne pathogen removal. So basically the idea that menstruation occurred to protect the uterus against colonization by pathogens transported by sperm.
Oh, fascinating. Right.
But this was a bad theory. I mean, yeah. I don't know if people still believe it, but menstruation occurs like weeks after like sex. Or like it can occur weeks after sex, in which case it would not be useful.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. I'm just going to end by basically asking myself the question and then answering the question. Why does any of this matter?
Great question.
Well, so being a person who menstruates or with a uterus or who is pregnant comes with a lot of specific dangers. Understanding the evolutionary biology of these things can help understand illnesses better. For example, understanding how invasive an embryo is helps us understand ectopic pregnancies better. Or understanding spontaneous digitalization can help us understand endometriosis. Which, by the way, endometriosis affects about 10% of all reproductive age women globally, which is an insanely high amount.
It's a huge number, yeah, and it's probably like underdiagnosed as
It probably is. And yet, what I've said before, has really only been deeply explored in the last 10 to 15 years.
So wild.
And that's because, you know, women's reproductive anatomy, evolution and disease are still some of the least understood areas of human biology due to a long history of stigma male-dominated medicine and research.
Yep.
Also still incredibly underfunded research. But we are seeing that slowly change. That's why these kind of ideas are coming around now. And there is a big future of interesting research ahead.
Yeah.
So, woo. Love that.
There you go.
Wow.
That was so interesting.
Good grief.
And just presented ideas about it that had never even gone through my little brain. That's so fab.
It's just delightful. Yeah. It's like we got a little bit of biology, we got a little bit of evolution, and then we got some comments about the patriarchy in there also.
Perfect. Yeah.
What more could you want from an episode?
It felt wrong not to end it on that note.
Well, yeah, because, like, to think that these, like, people with uteruses have been having periods throughout all of history, and yeah, only in the last 10 to 15 years have we figured out why. Like, absolutely insane.
It feels so especially spiteful, because it's like, that's how we were all born, y'all. Like,
every single person on this planet.
It's so important. Uh-huh. It's not just, like, a thing. It's how life happens. It's like a...
And to think there are some people out there who don't even understand how a period works.
Yes, well, exactly. Yeah. I hope that maybe there are some young people listening who got some useful stuff out of that beginning part. I should add an end of disclaimer saying, although sometimes I say woman or female or anything, I do mean just like anyone, obviously, with a uterus who has a period. And when I say mother, I did mean that, but I mean it in a very biological sense. Because when you refer to like an animal who has an offspring, you just say mother and offspring, and it's no emotional or social meaning behind that.
That's not a social statement. That's just a biological thing. Yeah.
There you go.
This episode's miscellaneous topic, I want to talk about the history of stickers. Because, like, stickers are everywhere, and, like, I didn't know where they came from before researching this.
By the sticker crane.
The sticker fairy. Can we guess?
So there are a few different answers to, like, when stickers were invented.
It's not like an apple falling on someone's head, or like, you know, like you act, someone had like a piece of paper and someone had some glue and they tripped and fell into each other. Like, it's a concept, right? Of just like sticking something up.
Yeah.
So it's not like so maybe there isn't such a singular origin necessarily.
So for we'll get into it a little bit more, but for like self-adhesive stickers, there definitely is like a specific moment where they became a thing. But do either of you two know, like, where, like, the vaguest, roughest idea of a sticker might have first been observed?
Just as, like, a warning label or something like that?
That's a great shout, but it's something even simpler than that.
You know, it's probably when prehistoric man first wanted to award their children for doing good in school and had, like, gold stars.
Nothing.
Awful.
What about merchants who were trying to price up their items?
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. So there's evidence of stickers sort of being traced back to even around 3000 BC.
No.
Which is ancient Egyptian times. So these aren't quite stickers in the way that we're thinking about them. But what they used to do, there's evidence of merchants who would create these sort of like signs and then plaster them on their products on the walls behind them, and things like that. So even though it's not quite like a sticker, it is like a sort of label, and like a really, really rough sort of like smidge of an idea of stickers maybe becoming a thing. So I thought it was worth mentioning. Even though it's not an actual sticker itself, it's still really cool that even back in like ancient Egypt, people were trying to stick things onto things to describe them or label them or something like that. And like, literally, they used to handwrite these stickers and then just glue them on. And I thought that was really, really cool. We do gradually get closer to stickers as well as we go on. The next thing is probably the Romans, who used to use something maybe closer to plasters to cover up blemishes on their skin. Which is really cool. They were called splenia, and they were literally like plasters you would stick onto your face to cover up spots and scars. They used them to protect the skin, so they did have like a more usefulness rather than a aesthetic thing. But they did also use them to like cover up their complexion and give them a more flawless finish on their face.
So they were like, they were the proto Olivia Rodrigo with stickers on their face.
But they used to do this in which is the one where they have really white skin.
Yeah,
you know, so they put the lead paint, face paint on, because they put like little hearts and stuff on their faces. Did.
So that's exactly where we were going next to around the 16th century in France.
Georgian types. Well, that's it's Georgian in the UK. Roughly.
Yeah, yeah. And they become much more sticker-like. They make them into nice little shapes. And this is because they used to have to cover up a lot of blemishes on their skin because people in the 16th century used to put lead basically straight onto their skin to give them that white complexion.
Didn't they all have to cover up pox scars all the time? Like
they
small
did.
Pox scars?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was all of those things like skin infections and stuff were really, really prominent.
Gross.
I do want to say in the, you know, evolutionary phylogeny of stickers that the development of shapes is really, that's important to me.
It's so interesting,
fun,
isn't
fun
it?
Fun shapes.
Yeah. So, like, these blemish stickers would be anything from, like, little stars and moons and suns to, like, you can see some which are tiny little people that they used to stick on their face to cover up their blemishes.
Okay. I literally joked that it was a Proto-Olivia Rodrigo, but it is. You're putting little stickers on your face.
Uh-huh. And, like, these were used up until, like, the 18th century, I think.
Wow. Let's bring them back. That sounds cute.
Well, we use them as, like, blemish stickers now to cover up our spots, to, like, draw the spot out. But I think having just fun things stuck on your face should definitely become a trend again. Yeah. So they became really popular. And by the 18th century, they could be seen not just in France, but across all of Europe. And they were worn by both men and women. So it wasn't just women who are wearing these fun stickers. There was also a lot of like social rules around them. So if you were wearing too many, you were seen as maybe a bit of like a little bit of a tart, bit of a ooh. If you weren't wearing enough, you were also seen as like not putting enough effort into your appearance and things like that.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
Oh no! I don't. Let's not bring them back. I don't want another standard to live by.
I don't know. Should it be two on left cheek, two on right? Is a star too much? Maybe just a moon.
But also, like,
I don't know.
Do I cover up every single blemish on my face, or do I deal with like people having to see all of that stuff and then also being thought of as being unkept? Like, there's no winning for these people. It's awful. So those are some like early ideas of stickers. Mm-hmm. But can you guess when the first sort of self-adhesive sticker was after this point? Or what it was?
I think about them so recreationally, mm-hmm. right? Like we almost don't have to preface, like, so what are stickers? Because, they're the things you slap on your desktop, on your notebooks, you put them on stuff. You see them, tagged everywhere on the streets sometimes. So I don't know. I mean,
can I think of maybe
an
early practical sticker that we might have used?
I know you mentioned like price tags as like a thing to quickly, or like label makers maybe is what I think of, but I don't know. That's all I can come to mind.
So the first adhesive sticker mm-hmm. was created in 1839 mm-hmm. by a very famous man called Sir Rowland Hill.
Oh, I thought it would be Sir Rowland Sticker.
Stupid. So stupid.
I'll take it. No, neither of you know who that person is then.
No, should we?
Sorry.
He's the man who invented the postage stamp.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yes.
Wow.
So Roland postage stamp.
There it is.
Just as funny the second time. Comedy.
The idea of a stamp had been around like from the 1600s, but it wasn't like a piece of paper that you stuck onto an envelope. It was a physical stamp that you would put
right.
onto parcels.
Oh, God. Yeah, stamp.
And stamps are also fun.
We love a stamp. So postal stuff is like the first adhesive thing.
Oh, that's so, yeah.
So this is one you lick.
Yes.
He invented.
Yeah. So it's not self-adhesive, but it's adhesive. So we will come on to the first self-adhesive sticker too.
In the third grade, we had pen pals, and we were mailing letters, and our teacher just brought out like sheets of postage stamps, and I was like, these are fun little stickers, and then proceeded to stick a lot on, like, on, like, a blank envelope or, like, a sheet of notebook paper, and she was like, ooh, Tom. Okay.
The stamps are so expensive.
We're going to learn a wonderful lesson today. And that's that. Which I blame stamps for being too darn fun. Shouldn't be that fun.
They're not wrong. It's so rude serious. Of them, honestly.
I just while we're on the topic of stamps, I will say I have the 50th anniversary Royal Mail Doctor Who collectible stamps.
Wow.
Ooh, that's cool.
They have all of the doctors on them, and plus and then you've got some of the monsters, and you've got like a TARDIS.
I love
and
that. Oh love my those. Goodness.
I love collectible stamps.
They're fab, aren't they? I used to work at an auctioneer's, and obviously we'd get like stamp collections through.
I feel like there's a lot of good stories you could be telling us.
There are so many stories. But I will tell about the first week that I worked there. I started working there when I was 15. I did like a week's work experience. I went back and worked there until I finished university. Anyway, in my first little week of work experience, it was like auction week. We had people coming in and visiting, and there was this one tiny little book of stamps. And it had been valued at about £1,000. So it was quite a lot of money anyway. But there were two people in that room who wanted that book of stamps. And in the end, I think it was literally about like this big. And it sold for £10,000 on the day. And it was just like, oh my goodness. Stamp collectors.
You gotta keep third grade me away from that.
Yeah. Anyway, back from our tangent, Hill wasn't looking to create stamps. He was looking for postal reform. Because, like, before this point, you didn't pay for parcels based on their weight. You just paid to have them sent off. So this was also, like, the first time that we had determined prices for your stamps, all of this stuff.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And it just happened to, like, continue with the creation of pieces of paper with, a glutinous wash on the back, which could be added to it. So it was all just happened to happen.
So dang interesting. Good grief. I was not expecting this little turn into the history of postage, which is also so interesting.
So, it's so cool, isn't it? So again, it's not quite self-adhesive stickers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we're getting
but
there.
It's so close.
We're close.
it's gonna take another 100 years to get to actual stickers.
Oh wow.
But an honorable mention is
I will also say, like just quickly, I know it's 100 years probably because it's like not important, but in my mind it's like they're like actively researching for 100 years. They're like in a lab somewhere, like, come on, make it stick.
So an honorable mention in the sticker journey is fruit labels. During the 1800s, there was a lot of competition between different fruit companies, I think specifically between apple companies. So to try and make them differentiate from each other, they would add these really brightly colored labels to the outside of their packaging. It was also like the birth of printing. So that made it easier to add these brightly coloured stickers to the front of them. And once again, it was a gum glue, which was also water activated. So it was just a participating factor in like the fruit war, basically, at the time. So again, doesn't quite count as stickers, yada, 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 whatever. The first self-adhesive sticker was made in 1935. By Roy Stanton Avery. So, the story goes that he took a $100 loan from his fiancée, which is around $2,050 today or £1,530 today, and he combined various pieces of machinery to create the first, and it was called a pressure-sensitive die-cut labelling machine.
Okay.
So, essentially, a self-adhesive sticker. So he created this machine. He founded the company called the Come Clean Products Company. That is spelt K-U-M, and I thought that was really funny.
It sure is!
that was a choice from their side. But the company then changed to Avery Dennison Corporation, which is still a company today. Oh, yeah. Still make labels today as well. And so they made self-adhesive stickers for labeling, pricing, and packaging. So it's a full circle back to what ancient Egyptians used to do with their prices on the wall. They made these specifically so that people could label prices of their products.
Wow.
I also think it's really interesting that Roy Avery died in 1997. So, like, the creator of the sticky label was alive at the same time as you two.
Huh.
But not all at right. the same time as me.
We get it. You're young. That was literally just a way to get you your age in.
Oh, I see.
The same time as you two.
At the same time as you people. But also just like to highlight how recent this all was.
Sure,
like,
sure. There are two people who are post-Avery and one person who is pre-Avery.
Yeah. So we have stickers that are used for pricing. But how did we get to the stickers that we are so in love with now? The answer is bumper stickers.
Okay.
I will shout out now a YouTube creator called Grackhouse, who their video really helped me on this whole topic, but especially this part. So go and give their video on the history of stickers some love, because it is really, really interesting. Ooh. So before the 1940s, people would use bumper signs. So what? They would physically tie these signs to their cars to...
The
honk
if you're horny signs.
Well, the New York Times says it was to advertise their opinions, which I thought was a very diplomatic way of
I personally have a huge vendetta against bumper stickers because I think they're so stupid, because it's like a one-way way. It's like throwing your it's like worse than throwing your opinions into like Twitter, because it's just you're saying one thing to one person and they just have to deal with it.
They just have to stare at the back of your car until
my child is an honor student. Great, what does that fucking mean to me?
I don't care.
I guess I won't crash into you then.
I'll take fine baby on board.
Those are the only valid stickers.
That's I'll give you that one.
So, in the mid-1940s, two men named Forrest Gill and his deputy Ed McConnell had an idea. Bumper stickers. So, Gill owned a printing shop. So he had the tools needed to create a bumper sticker. They sat there, measured out the size of the bumper that was out on the car that was outside, put some glow paint, which is like fluorescent, brightly coloured paint, onto a bit of adhesive paper and stuck it onto the bumper of their car, and that's kind of how bumper stickers were created. Gill went on to design and release actual bumper stickers with a design company, and those bumper stickers that were released by Gill were the first vinyl stickers with adhesive backs, which is also pretty cool. During the 1940s and 1950s, tourist attractions would start selling their own bumper stickers.
Of course, that makes sense.
Yeah, as like a trinket or like a souvenir of sorts to say, like, I went to this place, yay!
Which is one of the things I love about stickers is, like, they're just like little things that get to show you,
just like a little part of, like, your experience. And by the 1960s, bumper stickers were massively popular. There's a bit of a decline in bumper stickers now. A lot of cars are being created without bumpers at all. But during the 1960s, very, very popular. Now, corporations saw how popular these bumper stickers were. And capitalism being the way it is, we're like, we want to get in on that. So branded and decorative stickers started to emerge, including collectible stickers.
Football stickers are like football such stickers. A big one.
Really?
So it's been pretty much impossible for me to find like the actual first collection of stickers. But the honourable mention is the earliest one that I could find, at least, was a brand called Panini. They're still a brand now. And they created the earliest sticker album, which was the 1970 World Cup, which was hosted in Mexico.
Football stickers!
Football stickers! Yeah.
People love football stickers. They still make them now, all the time.
They are massively popular,
I love
absolutely.
Sticker books. I love collectible sticker books. Oh, I had a Harry so Potter good, collectible sticker book.
Yeah. So, as of 2018, the sticker industry is worth $31.2 billion.
Stupid.
So that's around £23.3 billion, which is
stupid.
Insane amount of money. You might disagree on if these count as stickers or not, but I do want to mention them because we live in a modern age, that digital stickers are now also a thing, technically.
Yeah.
I count it the same way I count NFTs as, you know,
as art,
you know.
But they're worth mentioning. This is sort of the direction that stickers have gone in. They were first created in like the early 2010s, as far as I'm aware. By 2013, Facebook had integrated stickers into part of their messaging and their interface. And by the end of 2013, a survey of mobile messaging users found that 40% of people who were surveyed used stickers on a daily basis. That number is probably much higher now.
Yeah, I don't know if this is just on iPhone, but what makes an iPhone sticker really a sticker, in my opinion, is that you can drag it over text and just like cover what people are saying, which is very important. And it feels very, very, very much the spirit of a sticker.
Yeah, and I think maybe not like early stickers really felt like stickers, but stickers we have now, such as stickers on Discord, feel more like stickers to me than like the emoji stickers.
I think maybe, yeah, even collectability is like an aspect of that,
yeah,
also.
Absolutely.
Kind of, yeah.
As of 2015, the digital sticker industry was worth around $10 billion.
Stupid.
I should add a pinch of salt with that figure because I struggle to find anything that corroborated that, but that's the figure that's floating around on the internet. But digital stickers are worth a lot of money these days as well. So yeah, that is a brief history of how stickers became a thing. Before I was on TikTok, I was like growing my following on Instagram with my art stuff, because I obviously do painting. And I made a bunch of friends on there who were other artists, and some of them sent me some of the coolest stickers that I just want to like shout out. Because a few of these are like hand-drawn stickers, basically. So there's this one, which is a pigeon, which I love so much.
Oh, yeah.
And this stag beetle. And they were both hand-drawn by some clever pseudonym on Instagram. So if anybody wants to go and give him some love, feel free to.
Amazing.
And then there was another one. Oh, every single like nature one on here is done by Carrie Rogers Art, who is like such a lovely woman on Instagram. And she was just like, oh, yeah, you won these stickers. And I was like,
that's sweet.
So yeah, or, like most of my stickers on my sketchbook are from like really lovely artists who I'm just like, oh, I just want to support you with some stickers.
When this episode drops, we'll show off pictures of our various sticker collections on our Discord.
We will, yeah.
And also, everyone should share their favorite stickers in the Discord.
Yeah.
God, I love stickers.
Tom, do you have a review for us?
It's review corner.
I do. This is a review from Tess Cat Jam on Apple Podcasts, and they say, good vibes all around. Such a wonderful podcast. I'm so glad to have found it. The hosts present beautiful and interesting topics, guiding you through understanding really complex ideas without making you feel stupid. Long episodes are edited well, so I find them perfect to go to sleep to. I read that and I was like, hold on. And then they go, and each day I can skip back to the bits I haven't heard yet. Okay.
Thank
so long as you're listening.
It's so long, it's boring. I fall asleep.
Yay!
But then they go back, which is great.
Yeah, that's very sweet. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that.
And then they go, a real joy to listen to. Thank you.
Thank you. What was their username?
Tess Cat Jam.
Thank you so much, Tess Cat Jam. That's so lovely. Also, great username.
Do you all have any plugs or shoutouts?
No.
That's a new one.
I will reiterate the artists that I shouted out earlier. And also the YouTube channel that I mentioned earlier, please do go and check those out. They are great creators. Also, you can follow me on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter. It's Caroline the Bug.
I'm Tom Lumperson, all places. Like I mentioned on the previous ep, the birthday card album is out at birthdaycardalbum.com. It's a music, poetry, art, TikTok thing collaboration that I got to help out with. It's really cool. And yeah. So today we learned about all the strange ways animals deal with heat. We learned about spontaneous decidualization, and not just what periods are, but theories about why they happen. And we learned the delightful story of stickers throughout history. And you can join us next time, where we'll learn about everything.
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced by Caroline Roper, Tom Lum, and Ella Hubber. Editing by Tom Lum and Ella Hubber. And music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
Caroline, is it, hold on, is it your birthday? This Wednesday?
Is your birthday to now?
Wednesday.
See, well, you know, happens. You don't get anything then. It's not your birthday today, right now.
It's my birthday week. There you go.
Oh, is that how it works? That's is it your birthday it month
oh,
also?
Oh, it's my birthday eve. It's my birthday Boxing Day. It's my birthday.
Oh, it's my birthday year this year, actually. I'll have you know.